Welcome to Cuke Audio Podcast, a presentation of Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his. My name is David Chadwick, and I'm the poobah of Cuke Archives. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. This is the first podcast for Cuke Audio. I hadn't planned on getting into podcasting quite yet, but since so many of us are staying home and not socializing in person, it got bumped up on the agenda, so I've looked into it some. Chose Podbean as the host. I do some amateur song recording, so I already had good equipment. The Focusrite Scarlett Studio 2i2. I think it means two ins and two outs. Except I just broke an essential piece of the mic stand, so I've got the mic tied to a cushion to the left of my computer, darn it. I apologize for any deficiencies in sound or content quality, and of course, we'll be listening to feedback and learning as we go. One thing I had to decide is how often to publish podcasts. I have been advised to stick to a schedule, so with trepidation, I commit to once a week. Right now, Tuesdays, where we're aiming. I'll try to get them up at 1 a.m. U.S. Pacific Coast time. I live in Bali, so that will be 4 in the afternoon for me on the same day. What I'm eager to do is to read some books I've written, starting off with Crooked Cucumber, The Life and Zen Teaching of Shunryu Suzuki, a biography I wrote about my teacher. It was published by Broadway Books, which is part of Random House, in 1999. It's 450 pages and is still in print. The plan is to make each of the chapters a separate podcast. There's 19 chapters, an introduction, and an epilogue, so that would be 21 podcasts. I also plan to add some comments. Maybe I'll get the first installment up next week. But I think I'll be adding a lot of other stuff as I do in this podcast. That's the idea for now. We'll see how it develops. So you may be asking, why Cuke? When Shunryu Suzuki was a young monk, his master called him Crooked Cucumber. Every day but Sunday, I post an excerpt from a Suzuki lecture on Cuke What's New blog. Often there's another post, likely having something to do with someone who studied with or knew Suzuki. There's as much in Cuke on the wide community of those who were there or involved in some way with Zen Center or Suzuki's life. I also try to get a post up daily on Cuke Nonsense blog, which gives me freedom to venture beyond the Cuke realm. I'm going to go to Cuke.com and share some verbiage from there that will give you a pretty good idea of what this is all about. We sent out a fundraising email earlier this month, the first one since 2012, and that email directed the recipient to go to the Cuke Archives 2020 presentation, which is fairly compact with a lot of neat old photos. The email was the same as the opening page on that presentation, so I'm going to read it. It's not too long, and suggest that you, dear listener, take a look at the other pages, too. Control Tower here. You forgot to say, if you go to the homepage of cuke.com, C-U-K-E.com, there's a prominent link right up top that says New Cuke Archives 2020 Presentation and Appeal for Support. But first, how about some words from Shunryu Suzuki, who we called Suzuki Roshi? Shunryu Suzuki gave this talk in San Francisco on November 16, 1969. The San Francisco Zen Center had just moved the day before from the old Sokoji Temple in Japantown, 15 blocks straight down Laguna de Page Street, to the new city center with spacious rooms for zazen, lectures, dining. There were rooms for offices and residential space for as many as 75 students. In this talk, he was setting a new tone for his students. None of them were ordained priests, but they'd be living in a semi-monastic situation. There'd be morning and evening zazen, services, lectures, a library, communal meals, house jobs. Some would work outside at various jobs. When he speaks here of special people, he does not mean they're better than others, just that they're in a unique situation, doing something new, and that together they would be establishing a practice appropriate for the time, place, and culture, as Buddhism has done for millennia. He clearly felt the import of the moment. This talk was used for the epilogue of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I'm reading the very beginning of it from the verbatim transcript that I lightly edited. This morning, I want to talk about our practice. Here in America, something special is happening. That is our group. Our students cannot be categorized in the same way we define Zen Buddhists in Japan, because you are not priests and you are not completely laymen. I understand it in this way. That you are not priests is easy to understand, but that you are not completely laymen is not. I think you are special people in our society, not hippie, but something like that, so I don't know what to say. I think you want some special practice, not exactly priest practice, not exactly layman's practice. We are on the way to have some different way of life for us. That is our Zen community. Not community, but our group. And so we have to have some appropriate practice for us. You can read the whole lecture in verbatim or edited form on shunryusuzuki.com. Just write in the date 69-11-16 or the word epilogue or in the drop-down for book. The last one is ZMBM, and that will bring up the list of all the lectures from that went into Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and the last one would be the epilogue. It was also the last talk he gave this group. It was the only one given in the city. All the rest were given in Los Altos at the Haiku Zendo. You can also listen to the audio there. And how about a little of that audio now? Here's what I just read as Suzuki said it.
This morning, I want to talk about our practice. I'm here in America. Something special is happening, and that is a group. Our students cannot be categorized in the same way we define Zen student, Zen Buddhist in Japan, because you are not you are not priest, and you are not completely layman. I understand it this way. Mm. that, you know, you are not pleased, it's easy to understand. But that you are not completely layman, it's... I think you are a special, you know, people in our society. Not hippie, but something like that. So I don't know what to say. So that is, I think you want some special practice, not exactly a priest practice, not exactly layman practice. And, but we are on the way to have special, you know, to have some different way of life for us. And that is Zen community, I think. Not community, but our group. And so we have to have some appropriate practice for us.
Appeal to keep Cuke Archives thriving. A message from David Chadwick. That's me. Back in 1966, at the age of 21, I rang the bell of Sokoji, a Soto Zen temple and the original home of the San Francisco Zen Center. I marvel now at how fortunate I was to have walked through that doorway, met Shinryu Suzuki, Dining Katagiri, and all the inspiring fellow students, friends, and teachers through the years that followed. 2 decades after Suzuki's death in 1971, I started to collect and organize stories and lectures which became material for Crooked Cucumber, The Life and Zen Teaching of Shinryu Suzuki. This effort has continued through the years, adding to and working with the archive of Suzuki's life and teaching, collecting memories of him, of those whose paths crossed his, of that unique, amazing time, and sharing all this with anyone interested. Cuke Archives' 2 principal online outlets are cuke.com, C-U-K-E.com, which concentrates on the oral and written history, and shinryusuzuki.com. I'm not going to spell that out now. There's a link to it at the top of cuke.com. It's for the archive of Suzuki's lecture transcripts, audio, video, and photos. Take a look at the photograph below. Haha, you can't see it. But actually, you can. Just hang on a second. Taken in the fall of 1967 at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, the first Zen Buddhist monastery in the West, is the oldest Tassajara group photo we have. In the thousands of pages of Cuke.com, there are memories from and of almost everyone in this photo. Note to listener, this photo is used for the banner on Cuke Audio's homepage on Podbean, but it's just as easy to see it by going to Cuke.com's homepage and clicking on the prominent link up top to Cuke Archives 2020 presentation and appeal for support. It's been almost 8 years since the last fundraising drive for Cuke Archives, called Crooked Cucumber Archives back then. I much prefer doing the daily work and giving it all away, supporting this endeavor with my own funds, and what blessed donations come in unsolicited. But we have arrived at the point where we must appeal for support in order to continue. In 2013, my mother died in her 99th year. I was with her the last few months, an inspiring experience. Later that year, my wife and maid of 16 years, Katrinka McKay, and I left for Asia, where we knew our limited resources would stretch much further. We settled in Bali. We live around good people, meditate, do yoga, swim, walk a lot, don't own a vehicle, and have a small footprint. She helps people with substance abuse problems. I'm just as in touch with family, friends, and fellow travelers of the way as before, and I find our simple life conducive to focusing on work. Please visit our goals, an overview, who we are, and the statements of support to read what others have to say about the import of continuing this work. To me, above all, this activity is a wonderful way to say hello to each other, to acknowledge our mutual divinity as it has been from the day in 1966 when I first arrived at the Zen Center. Thank you very much for your consideration. David Chadwick. The Cuke Archives presentation includes a page with 30 statements of support from Shunyu Suzuki's Dharma heirs, Hoitsu Suzuki and Richard Baker, from Zen teachers in the Suzuki lineage, Ed Brown, Peter Coyote, Linda Ruth Cutts, Norman Fisher, Leslie James, Wendy Johnson, Dan Layton, Pat Phelan, Lou Richmond, Paul Rosenblum, Peter Schneider, Alan Sanake, Peter Vandersteer, and Michael Winger. Teachers from other lineages, Joan Halifax, Jack Kornfield, David Schneider, John Tarrant, Brad Warner. There are statements from Stephen Frost, a Catholic priest, writing guru Natalie Goldberg, poet Jane Hirschfield, Thomas Moore, who wrote Care of the Soul, East Asian religions professor John Nelson, religion and sociology professor and Suzuki student Steve Tipton, photographer and neighborhood activist Barbara Wenger, landscaper Carol Williams. And they're all writers, most of them published. I'm going to read one of these statements now from Michael Katz, literary agent, Cuke Archives co-conspirator, primary advisor, mentor, and major supporter. This quote from near the end of a New Yorker article about San Francisco reminds me of the value of Cuke and all David Chadwick does. Long before the founding of Rome, the Etruscans measured time by something called the seculum. A seculum spanned from a given moment until the last people who lived through that moment had died. It was the extent of first-hand memory for human events, the way it felt to be there then. The concept is useful because it helps announce a certain kind of loss, the moment when the lessons that cannot be captured in the record disappear. The seculum of people who remember the early days of Zen Center is winding down. The secula of people who remember early Tassajara days, the transition to Richard Baker, and his years as abbot are thinning out. When the last people who remember what each of these felt like is gone, something more than conventional history will be lost. A Zen Center is all about the experience, what it's like to do the practice, to encounter the teacher, the other people practicing, and where their lives led. Cuke shows the value of that. I think of Richard Baker's statements at Graham Pecci's funeral ceremony even David's Bill Lane dream. I'm just expressing my appreciation and explaining why I continue to support Cuke. During the next piece of time, Suzuki Roshi's seculum will end, and no living person will remember practicing with him. Let's get this gift, this incomparable treasure, ready for the future. David Chadwick needs our support during the countdown to when those who were there are no more. Thank you, Michael. My Bill Lane Dream, August 8th, 2018. I had this dream last night where I'd come upon one of Norman Fisher's sittings that was just getting over. I didn't see Norman, just a lot of old San Francisco Zen Center students walking out in pairs. He has a lot of old Zen Center students, but the cast of characters in the dream, though real figures in my past and present, were not selected in my memory from his actual pool of students in waking life, or, as Ramana Maharshi called it, Dream One. Wendy Johnson and Peter Rudnick were near the end of the line, and we hung out some. And Bill Lane was walking next to someone. I can't remember who, can't see the face. It was a guy. And after the pairs dispersed and went their separate ways, he and I stood there talking, and I said to him, "Oh, it was nice to see Bill Lane here." And he said, "Bill Lane's not here. He died." I said, "Yes, I know, but he's here and was walking right next to you." We just had Nyepi last Wednesday, March 25th. Nyepi happens the day before the traditional New Year on what's called the Saka calendar. It's Hindu and mainly celebrated in Bali, but it's a public holiday in Indonesia. More than that, though, it's not a normal holiday. You're not supposed to have light or fire. It's a day and night in the dark for fasting and meditation. And it's illegal to go out, and there are sentries who can catch you and herd you back home and arrest you if you resist. It's the only place in the world where the airport closes. The airport doesn't have a lot of traffic these days anyway, but living a half hour from it, I know there are some flights. I guess they're cargo? A lot of Bule or foreigners leave or go to hotels to continue some semblance of normal life. Katrinka and I love Nyepi. My favorite thing to do on Nyepi is to sneak out in the dark, dark, dark and look at the stars. Where we lived the first 3 years here, there was a nice big swimming pool at the hotel next door we could use, and it was a walk straight out the door of our apartment for about 50 feet. I'd walk over there in the dark, get in the water, and lie on my back and look at the stars so revealed by the darkness of Bali. Really, everything's dark. Hotels can do what they want inside, but can't cast light out. So it's a rare night sky, like being in the Rocky Mountains in the States on a summer night. Sometimes it's cloudy here for Nyepi, and that's too bad. But sometimes it's clear. That's magic. Everyone cheats, I hear. I do. This year, I went outside the gate and tiptoed down our little dead-end street to the side street and laid down on the asphalt looking up. There weren't any clouds. Wow. Also, I work on my laptop. I have plenty of work to do without Wi-Fi. If Katrinka's here, which she's not, she's in Oregon with her son, and she wasn't here last year either. Anyway, if she's here, we'll watch some flicks. There's no Wi-Fi, but there's electricity. Not everywhere, though. Some remote places without a lot of refrigerators and infrastructure that needs it got the electricity, too. But we don't have lights on. We use a few candles. And recently I've started fasting a day a week, so all I had was water and a little green tea. Yuppie ought to be global. It is so great. I had an unusual experience that started at the tail end of this Nyepi. Here's a little something about it called Day After Nyepi Bloodbath. Katrinka and I each have a Muslim prayer rug on the floor where we step off the bed. We didn't know they were Muslim prayer rugs when we bought them in Penang, Malaysia, from a charming salesman. Each of them has a little semicircle chewed out of it from when Dogget Bandi was less mature and restrained. For years, I've stepped down on mine with no problem, but in the dark, dark, wee Nyepi hours, I woke and rose to pee, stepped off the bed, stood, and lightning fast slipped and banged my head hard against the corner of my bedside table, collapsed on the floor in pain and shock, dizzy, gasping, groaning. As I gained awareness, my right ear seemed to be ground zero of the disaster. I could feel liquid coming out of it and thought, oh no, did I puncture this one too? I'd punctured my left eardrum last fall before sleeping, and a clear liquid kept coming out of it and continued through the night and into the next day, till the bed was soaked the next morning. It took a couple of months to heal, so I could hear, swim, and bathe normally again. Back to me on the floor, wondering if I'd punctured my other eardrum. I wanted to just lie there and sleep, but I knew I needed to pee, and so sleeping in this condition seemed unwise. So after a moment of returning to earth, crawled to the bathroom, peed kneeling, stood up, walked back to the bed, holding on to what I could till I was in it. Woke up. Still dark. Wetness. The pillow. Sheet. My t-shirt. My head. All were wet. I still thought it was ear fluid, like had happened before. Carefully walked to the bathroom. I realized I had to turn on the light there. And gosh, I was bleeding. I'd been bleeding for hours. My t-shirt was wet with blood, and there was dry blood too. Ouch, pulling it over my head. Blood dripping as I washed it in the sink. There were gobs of clotted blood in the t-shirt. After a minute, lay it on the side of the sink. Looked in the mirror. Blood on my chest. Half the hair on my head wet with blood and dry blood places too. Meanwhile, I kept dripping. Not sure where it's from, ear, head behind ear. I must have been bleeding for hours. Obviously, hadn't lost too much because I wasn't dizzy. And I have lost too much blood, and it was quite unpleasant, as well as life-threatening. I knew I needed to put pressure on the wound. I got a washcloth and tried, but I couldn't tell exactly where it was bleeding. It was my ear or behind my ear. Sat on the edge of the bed, holding the washcloth against it and waiting for 6 a.m. when Nyepi is officially over and we can have activity again. Got into a zone. At 6:15, called Dear Cadet, our housekeeper, and told her what was up. Her husband, a driver I've known since we first arrived, offered to come over and take me to the hospital, but I said, that won't be necessary. I hated to bother her on New Year's Day, Normally, people go in mass to the beach to purify, but because of the virus, I don't know what they had planned. Surely special offerings at home. There are offerings every day, so extra offerings and also no coming to work. She comes 3 days a week, but this week we were going to do two. But today's a double special day. Incidentally, we're required by law to have a housekeeper. Part of getting our residence visa is submitting a copy of her ID card to immigration. She arrived at 7:15. By then, I'd stopped the bleeding with continual pressure and had managed single-handedly to prepare my morning hot water, then drink some jamu, a traditional medicinal drink, eat 4 prunes, an oatmeal cookie, and was drinking tea and reading the news as she walked in. Morning meditation had been cut short by circumstances, shortened to the time I spent holding the washcloth to my ear. Kadek immediately asked if I was dizzy, and I said no. She asked if I had lost consciousness. I said, I don't think so, but maybe for a few seconds. I told her I'd fasted, and she said she thought maybe I just thought I'd slipped on the rug, but really I had fainted. Oh, yeah, maybe so. I never have slipped on that rug. It happened so fast it could have been I slipped, but it could be that I fainted and that smashing my head into the corner of the table woke me up a second later. I remember crying out, taking in that heavy hit, surely one of the heaviest in my life. I laughed, showing her the bloody bed, floor, bathroom, t-shirt. She was cleaning up and I was waiting for 8 a.m. and the hospital to open for regular business. I didn't want to go to the emergency room because I thought it might cost more. She told me that actually this year Nyepi is 2 days. The second one allowing lighting and Wi-Fi, but not going out except to buy food and necessary stuff. She lives 30 minutes from here. She said she was stopped 3 times on the way here by Pechalang, the neighborhood security officers. Not the police, but more important often. She said she'd explained the purpose of her trip, and each time they waved her on. This second day of Nyepi is something new, and obviously in response to the virus. Good idea. I had the last of the leftover oatmeal cooked with banana, dried apricots, and sunflower seeds. We didn't know if I could get a taxi. If not, she could take me in her motor scooter, though I wouldn't wear a helmet with my head like that. I was too weak to walk there unless I had to. It's only 20 minutes away. Kadek asked if I didn't want her to clean some of the blood off me and pointed out it was still bleeding into the shirt I'd put on, a very dark shirt, so it wasn't obvious. She asked if she could bring me another shirt. I told her I wanted them to see all the blood. Used my Bluebird taxi app, and it took longer than usual, but got a positive response 1/2 kilometer away, so I grabbed the essentials, including a face mask, which Philippine neighbor Yvonne had kindly given me. Kadek showed me how to wear it, and the driver arrived before I could get out on the street. Only the emergency room was open at the hospital. They immediately brought out a gurney, had me lie on it, and wheeled me just inside the swinging doors. A young woman and a young man with face masks on stood over me. She asked if I spoke Indonesian, and I said I preferred it, but it wasn't perfect, and I was sure her English was better, so whatever she wanted. So we used both. They could see the blood and all. I just told them I'd fallen and that I didn't know exactly what sort of wound I had. They did not ask anything about payment until they'd heard what I had to say, taken a look for themselves, knew there was nothing life-threatening going on. I gave her my card for the hospital, Bali Mandara, and that's all they needed. It will bring up my record there. I was there 2 hours and spent no time to speak of waiting for anything. There was someone with me the whole time. He did the work right there inside the door on the gurney. And we talked some. I had to look a few words up with my iPhone, which was a little awkward, getting my glasses, pulling it out of my pocket while he's working on my ear. I asked him what Mandara meant. It's just in names here, names of new government-related things. This public hospital, the toll road. It wasn't in Google Translate. He said he didn't know. It was something positive. So, turned out it was all ear. Kadek had thought it was head, too, because of all the caked blood. I got 8 stitches. I think 5 in front and 3 in back. He said it was really hard to do because it was uneven. Now I've got an ear wrapped in bandages. They told me not to get it wet and to go to a local clinic for control. This is how they say check up, or in this case, get the bandage changed. There's a nice little clinic, a 20-minute walk from here. Before I left the hospital, the guy carefully cleaned my head and hair off and my neck, so I'd be responsible for cleaning below there. Didn't have to worry about getting it wet or anything. He took me over to where you pay, and I waited a little bit outside, and I paid. And right next to there was a place where a little tiny pharmacy, and she gave me the antibiotics and some ibuprofen they wanted me to take. Taxied home, arriving a little more poor than when I left. The 2 taxi rides added up to about $4. Hospital and medicine in the emergency room, about $45. Super nice, modern, efficient, friendly public hospital. Wow. Kadek was almost finished with the cleanup when I got home. I thanked her most politely and told her to go home. She insisted on watering the front and back garden and was off. I fell on the clean bed and slept a couple of hours. Then I took a hot bath. Felt a little weak, but clean. Used the bed as my desk for the rest of the day. When I was home from the hospital, I'd been home hours, I researched the meaning of Mandara, as in the name of the hospital, Bali Mandara. Ruma Sakit, Bali Mandara. Ruma Sakit, Ruma House Sakit, Sick. That's a hospital. I found a lot for the word. It's Sanskrit, and there are mountains, people, a lot of stuff. But for the toll road here, they gave it a new meaning. It's a very short toll road. It just helps people get to the airport and a few other places, going out over the bay, where it shouldn't be really, but I won't get into anything environmental right now. So they gave it a new meaning, saying it was a new word, a composite of 4 Indonesian words, maju meaning to advance, implying progress, aman, safe, Damai, peace, and this word I didn't know, kesejahteraan, meaning prosperity or welfare. It means this toll road is a sign of progress and public safety and peace and welfare. That's a word that a bureaucracy dreamed up, huh? But anyway, it's a nice word, Mandara. So getting back to the hospital, while I was on the gurney there, getting my ears pierced, so to speak, I wasn't spending most of that time in idle chatter with the attendant who was doing the sewing. Mainly he was concentrating on closing up the wound in my ear, and I was doing what I always do in such a situation. By such a situation, I mean a situation where I can't escape pain. our anticipation of pain or fear of pain, resistance to pain, which all that's usually what's really disturbing about pain, are in the dentist chair while they're grinding and drilling in my mouth. Even if it's not hurting, I am aware of the possibility. The same thing always happens. I remember the feeling of the needle going into the ear, injecting painkiller. And since it was pre-painkiller, I felt the qualities of thin, sharp, cold steel advancing into nerves. And then I still felt the stitching needle that went in and on and on and on. He just kept doing it. It went on forever. At times like that, in the dental chair, or when there's some procedure happening, or for some reason I have some sort of discomfort I can't get out, it might be just being sick or in some way. At those times, I get overwhelmed with a feeling of great sympathy for the suffering of all beings. I understand them more deeply, what usually doesn't get through to me. And for a long time now, what I do and what I did in the hospital is repeat over and over, may all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. When I was a kid, something I'd hear now and then, someone would say, "Hey, what would you wish if you had any wish in the world?" And people would say different things. And I always said the same thing. And I don't ever remember deciding to say it. It was just the only thing that ever occurred to me. I'd say, I wish that everybody everywhere was happy forever. I remember being a kid and I really cared about other people. I felt their suffering or something. I mean, most of the time I didn't. I wasn't thinking about that. I was just having fun. I had a pretty nice childhood. It was pretty happy. I was really lucky. But sometimes I would get the feeling about others. I could feel like they're suffering or something, or I could see that. Well, I remember one experience I had. I was with my mother. I think it was at Dallas at a show. Like, I was very young. And we were walking in the lobby, I think after it was over. And maybe the show, something in it had made me feel sort of emotional or something. But I saw a little girl about my age, walking with her mother. And I looked at her and I instantly realized she was going to die. And I just broke out sobbing. And my mother, my poor mother, she was, "Well, what?" You know, she tried to console me. She didn't know why. And I didn't say. And it didn't last long. It went away. And once, again, very young. I mean, I was so young then. I was walking with her, holding her hand. That's how young I was. And once, when she read me the story of Hannibal crossing the Alps with the elephants and all that, and it was a great story, you know, about Hannibal's life. And at the end, Hannibal committed suicide by drinking the poison from his ring. He always carried a ring with some poison in it. And I just checked that on Wikipedia. I've never checked it. And that is true. And after she read that, again, I just broke out crying. And that wasn't normal. I didn't cry a lot. So I just look back on my past and I remember these things. And because it seems to me I was more compassionate back then than I am now. But I'll get to that. There's another side to it. One thing is that my parents instilled in my sister and me a caring about animals and realizing that animals had feelings. And I got into collecting butterflies. You know, maybe I was about 8, and my mother really didn't like that. And she got to me. Eventually, I'd put some butterfly in a jar, and then I'd put some ammonia in it and a little cotton swab, and I'd watch it die. And I realized, oh, my God, that's horrible. Why am I doing this? And I'd seen kids burn ants and stuff, and I didn't, you know, it takes a little time to realize, you know, that. So I realized the vertebrates had feelings very young. I was at my grandmother's house, pretty young, maybe 6, 7 years old. There were some kids playing in a vacant lot across the street. I went over to see them, and they had this baby bird. And I think I was 7 years old or something. I just went apeshit. I said, no, you can't do this. No, what? Stop, stop. And I started crying, and I said, the poor little bird, and just like that. I went back, and I sat on her porch, and one of the kids came up to me later with the bird in a box, and it wasn't dead. And I tried to take care of it and help it, but of course it died. I remember even as a teenager, I can see now, walking down the sidewalk in Fort Worth and looking at people through the windows of a bus and seeing them and having this feeling, this sad feeling about them. Like in a sense, I was feeling their suffering, or in the long term, not like they were necessarily suffering right then, but like this veil of tears, you know, that life was difficult. Whatever they were thinking, things were going to change or whatever, their hopes and dreams would fall apart, whatever. I don't know. I mean, I don't get that feeling now. I look back at that. Very interesting. So various things happened in my life, and I ran into Buddhism, and I met the Four Noble Truths. And at that time, I was more, you know, I'd gotten into more spiritual seeking, and you know, through LSD, and but also the influence of my father and mother, especially my father, who was really into sort of cosmic religion, cosmic Christianity or whatever. Not even, didn't even say Christianity necessarily. So I was more enlightenment oriented than saving all beings oriented. So at the Zen Center, at the San Francisco Zen Center in 1966, when I went there, I ran into the Four Noble Truths. And the first one is, life is suffering. And it's more complex. It's dukkha. It means, it can mean incompleteness. It means I can't get no satisfaction, you know, ultimately. There's various definitions of dukkha. But anyway, I ran into that Four Noble Truths and into the Bodhisattva's vow. Also, I had an interesting experience one day. I was reading in the Abhidharma about the dharmas. Now, and these, this is not dharma. I know anybody who's a Buddhist will know this, but just making sure. There's a meaning of dharma, meaning the teaching. But there's another meaning, like constituent elements of all that is, are things that have intrinsic value or something. So I was reading, and early Buddhism, the Abhidharma, they broke everything down, you know, eye, ear, nose, mouth, seeing, hearing, smelling, and all sorts of things. You know, there's like a zillion dharmas, and one of them was compassion. And they list the dharmas under wholesome and unwholesome, and compassion was listed under wholesome. But guess what was on the unwholesome side? Pity. And I read that then, and I thought, you know, there's a reason that I got out of that sort of feeling I had when I was younger. It wasn't wholesome. It wasn't helpful. He was just sort of maudlin, or, you know, an occasional, oh, poor people feeling. I can understand it, but I really liked reading that because sometimes you might get the feeling like, well, I'm not being compassionate, when you actually might be realizing you're not having a helpful type of feeling regarding other people's suffering. At the Zen Center, I got into the four vows. Not heavy, and Zen Center wasn't into it heavy either. It was just part of a bigger package, like we chant it, but not daily. Like for lectures, we chant the four vows. And then once a month during the Ryaku Fusatsu ceremony, very popular ceremony, it's almost like a musical production. Well, it is compared to everything else that we chanted at the Zen Center. I say the four vows in the morning here. Not always. It's not, again, it's still not my major practice, but I do quite a bit, but I say it in Japanese because I studied in Japanese, and also chanting in Japanese, there's less confusion about the meaning. And it's Shujo Muhen Seigan Do, Bono Mujin Seigan Dan, Homon Muryo Seigan Gaku, Butsudo Mujo Seigan Jo. As a translation, and there are many, I use, beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to sever them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. But in the morning here, the first thing I chant, and I usually do so silently, as soon as I start doing my walking meditation in the morning, and I got into this because of doing Vipassana retreats here, so being around Theravadins, but also the Hindus here do, a lot of the Hindus do it, and there's a, or they're all familiar with it, I know. There's a Chinese, Balinese Buddhist teacher I do retreats with. He doesn't, his retreats are non-sectarian. He has Muslims and Christians. He's very big all over Indonesia. This is the big thing for them. They start every meditation with it. They end every meditation with it. Now they start every meeting and end every meeting with it. And that is the simple line, may all beings be happy. In Indonesian, it's semoga semua hidup berbahagia. And I don't do that in Indonesian in the morning. What I do is, may all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Well, that wraps it up for Cute Audio Podcast for today. Thank you for joining us. Come back next Tuesday and we'll get together again. And if you want to help keep Cute Audio going, just go to cuke.com, C-U-K-E.com, and there's a donate link up top, right over the word donate, and on the bottom of the page. I'll link to it from our Podbean page too, and there'll be a link to the Cuke Audio Podbean page at the homepage of Cuke.com as well. I've got some work to do there, like some fascinating notes about this episode. We'd love you to become a subscriber via PayPal. How about $1 a month? There is a minimum though. It's zero. And if that's all you can set aside for Cuke, then just mail an empty envelope or blow us a kiss. We're somewhere out there in the cyberspace. Take care of yourself and don't let that nasty virus get near you or your loved ones. So till next week, I'm David Chadwick, all alone here at home with my wife in America. Hi, Katrinka. And I'm the Poobah of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio, wishing you a grand awakening.